Our next case this morning is Washington against the Illinois Department of Revenue. Mr. Baker.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Baker, and I am here today representing the plaintiff, Chrissy Washington. The issue that we have brought before this court is, when does the prima facie case in a Title VII context, when does in a Title VII retaliation claim, should an employee be required to establish that they sustained an adverse employment action? Just a brief factual background.
I just want to ask you very quickly, Mr. Baker, there was an unpublished opinion in this court, which was published on Friday. Have you seen Firestein versus Parkview Health System?
Judge Rogner, I apologize. I have not.
Okay. It's very helpful to you, actually, in that regard.
And that was a case that was just published?
Yes. It had been an unpublished decision. And in it, the panel noted that although Parkview directs its response to whether Firestein suffered an adverse job action, retaliatory conduct that can incur liability is not so limited in scope.
And I think that that's a correct analysis. And not having read the case, I apologize, and I don't want to...
Well, it was Friday. That's why you have to always look at that computer.
I apologize, Judge Rovner. This court in the past has not adopted the specific test that I am asking you to adopt today. The D.C. Circuit, in the Passer case, outlined a modified prong of the prima facie case. And this is strictly for the Title VII retaliation claims. And what Passer said is we're going to get rid of the adverse employment action element and replace that with an action having an adverse impact upon the individual. And I believe
that... what exactly is the difference between adverse action and adverse effect?
The adverse...
The more these little subtle verbal distinctions get drawn, the harder it is to understand what in the world is going on. So if you could just articulate what you see as the important difference of principle between these two things that sound to an untutored ear to be identical, maybe that would help.
And I will do that, Judge Easterbrook, to the best that I can. Certainly, an adverse employment action is something that is limited to the scope of employment. And I believe that if you review Section 703 of Title VII, which is the underlying discrimination provision of Title VII, it talks about...
What the statute says is you're not allowed to engage in discrimination, and it's actually the same language for retaliation as for other things. That's all the statute says. It says no discrimination. No one has ever supposed, I would have thought, that discrimination is limited to what happens at work. If the employer hires a team of goons and sends them to go shoot up the houses of black employees, it's violated Title VII, even though the shooting doesn't occur on the employer's premises. We all agree about that?
I would rely on this court's decision, and I can't pronounce it correctly, but the Hearn-Rettier case, where that issue was addressed, and I believe the way Judge Posner addressed that issue is that...
Nobody shot up anybody in Hearn-Rettier.
No, they didn't, but Judge Posner posed that exact scenario.
It doesn't make any difference who writes the opinions of this court.
Judge Easterbrook, I would respectfully suggest that Section 703 and 704 are different, that their wording is different. And I would point...
And what's the difference in wording that you're relying on?
Well, I would point out the EEOC interpretation.
No, what is the difference in the wording of the statutes that you are relying on?
On Section 703... Violations of Section 703 are limited to an unlawful employment practice.
Would you kindly quote the language of the statute that you want us to look at?
Section 703A. Declares it to be an unlawful employment practice to violate Title VII's substantive prohibition against discrimination with respect to specified actions by employers, all of which are related to employment.
Yeah.
Section 704 is the retaliation provision, which says that it's an unlawful employment practice to discriminate against someone who has filed a charge.
All right. Well, that's the magic word, discriminate. Now, since that is the substantive norm for non-retaliation cases, and the very same word is used for retaliation cases, why should there be any legal difference?
Your Honor, again, I would point to the interpretive guidelines that have been issued by the EEOC. And if I might quote from those, Judge Easterbrook, the Commission's position is based on statutory language and policy considerations. The anti-retaliation provisions are exceptionally broad. They make it unlawful to discriminate against an individual because his or her protected activity. This is in contrast to the general anti-discrimination provisions, which make it unlawful to discriminate with respect to an individual's terms, conditions, or privileges of employment. The retaliation provisions set no qualifiers to the term to discriminate, and therefore prohibit any discrimination that is reasonably likely to deter protected activity. They do not restrict the actions that can be challenged to those that affect the terms and conditions of employment. Thus, a violation will be found if an employer retaliates against a worker for engaging in protected activity through threats, harassment in and out of the workplace, or any other adverse treatment that is reasonably likely to deter protected activity by the individual or other employees. So I believe, and I believe that the EEOC has recognized, that there is a distinction between the two provisions. And I do believe that the language in Passer allows this court and allows practitioners to understand what the appropriate prima facie case should be in a Title VII retaliation case. Now, I would suggest that in the Passer case, the facts of that case, the plaintiff was not allowed to conduct a symposium that he had previously been allowed to conduct. I would suggest, under the way this court has previously interpreted the adverse employment action, that would probably not rise to the level of an adverse employment action. Under Passer's approach, which discusses an adverse impact, I do believe, and I believe the D.C. Circuit stated, that it does rise to the level of an adverse impact. So I do believe that there are some distinctions between the two. Whether this court decides to accept or reject the Passer approach, I do believe that the district court erroneously determined that Ms. Washington was not able to establish that she had sustained an adverse employment action. We have relied heavily on the Collins case. There are certainly a number of cases from this circuit which seem to suggest that merely a lateral job transfer is not sufficient to establish a prima facie case. I do believe a fair look at the collection of all of those cases suggests that a factual analysis needs to be made for each particular case. I do see that my light is on, so I will reserve the remaining of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Certainly, Mr. Baker. Ms. Wittgen.
May it please the Court, Nadine Wickern, on behalf of the defendant appellees, the Illinois Department of Revenue. There are several grounds on which this Court may affirm the judgment of the District Court in this case. First, as this Court has been discussing, under the McDonnell-Douglas burden-shifting test, Ms. Washington was required to show that she suffered an adverse employment action, and she did not do so. Furthermore,
Where does this adverse employment action thing come from? It's not in the statute.
That is correct.
Statute says you can't discriminate, right?
Correct.
So let's suppose an employer puts all the white employees on the day shift and all the black employees on the night shift. Think there's any problem under the statute?
It would depend on whether the night shift was seen as undesirable, as some of the other cases tell.
It's the night shift. Or the employer allows all the white employees to have flex time and none of the black employees to have flex time.
If there's
a search for adverse employment impact would just be absurd in that kind of case. It'd be blatant discrimination. An injunction would be issued in 10 minutes.
Right.
Nothing, right?
Correct.
We need to figure out whether this is discrimination within the purpose of the statute and not some statutory, not some substitute that people make up for the language. I mean, sometimes a focus on adverse effect or something can help you figure out whether discrimination has gone on. But that's not, one has to be careful about replacing the actual statute with some verbal formula used in opinions.
That's correct, Your Honor. And in discrimination cases, we have the same thing, and that's where this adverse employment action, similarly situated, protected class, you know, all of those same elements are used in discrimination cases. It's become a vehicle for which plaintiffs can submit their case to the court and try to establish their claim when they don't have direct or circumstantial direct evidence to show that they've been either discriminated or retaliated against. It's become a crutch by which a plaintiff can use to overcome the summary judgment hurdle, which did not occur in this case. The actions that were taken against Ms. Washington were that she was laterally transferred to a position where she had the same pay, the same benefits, the same title, the same duties, in the same building. The only differences here were she was under a different supervisor, and then the new position she went to did not allow her flex time. Under this court's precedent in defining what adverse employment action means in both discrimination and retaliation cases, this court has held that under these factual circumstances, under the broad test that this court uses to determine whether an adverse employment action has been taken, these types of actions do not fall under that test.
And could you relate this to the statute in some way? And here's what troubles me. Let's suppose, as we probably have to suppose in this kind of litigation, that the person making these decisions is Catbert, the evil director of human resources lifted right out of the Dilbert comic strip. Right? And what Catbert does when an employee does something is figure out what that employee's vulnerabilities are. Right? And Catbert then takes advantage of the vulnerabilities. Let's suppose one particular employee just responds by going into physical paroxysms on hearing Mozart. Now, for most people, hearing Mozart would be a benefit, but this employee just can't stomach Mozart. And so Catbert makes sure that Mozart music is piped into her room, and needless to say, the employee becomes more docile, won't complain anymore. Right? And Catbert then finds out that some other employee really needs flex time to care for her daughter. Right? And in order to retaliate against that employee, Mozart won't work, but we'll find some way to deny flex time. For the normal employee, that would be completely transparent. Nobody would care. But you got an employee with a special vulnerability, and Catbert zeroes in on the vulnerability. Now, I don't see how asking what's an adverse action in the normal case is going to help us figure out whether we've got Catbert on our hands or whether this is just a normal action unrelated to the complaints and so on.
I wouldn't disagree with Your Honor as a personal or philosophical matter. This court, though, and other courts have established the McDonnell-Douglas test as a way for a plaintiff to support their claim.
The McDonnell-Douglas test is a useful heuristic in some percentage of cases. It is not the statute itself.
That's correct.
I've now made this point several times.
We need
to apply the statute.
And I wouldn't disagree with that, Your Honor.
Seems to me that our court's opinion in both McDonnell versus Cisneros and Prinsky versus Fleur Daniel pointed out that the language of Title VII's anti-retaliation provision is different from and arguably broader than the other provisions of the statute. And Section 704A talks about the discrimination against an employee who has opposed unlawful practices rather than altering the compensation, the terms, the conditions, and the privileges of employment. Why then, I wonder, should an employee complaining of retaliation be required to prove an adverse employment action?
Well, already under this court's precedent, the court takes a broad view of what that can be and looks at the specific facts of the case. For example, in some situations, a lateral transfer, or what can be characterized as one, would be an adverse action if, as in some of the other cases that were discussed in the briefs, there were cases in which the transfer would lead to less further promotional opportunities for the employee. There was one DCFS case where the adoption bureau had more opportunity than another bureau, and by transferring it, it would lead to an adverse action related to that person's employment.
Okay, forgive me, because time is getting short. Giving Washington the benefit of reasonable inferences, a fact finder could find that the articulated rationale here for the change was pretext. You've got the state reclassifying rather than eliminating her old position, doing so 4 years after she first complained about insufficient work, but only 1 month after the Department of Human Rights ruled against her on her discrimination charge. You've got management-directed transfers, which were concededly rare at the Department of Revenue. There are indications that Tapscott, who was the prime mover, had an axe to grind against Washington. You know, he wouldn't let that person attend the meeting where Washington was told she would have to transfer. He wouldn't sign her positive evaluation form. There are some other things. Washington was transferred to a position where her predecessor had been permitted to maintain a flexible schedule, but she is not. And Tapscott is being copied on correspondence about Washington's request for flex time, even after Washington is transferred and no longer under his command.
Your Honor, a lot of these facts that you've put forward are not based on any facts in the record. The summary judgment standard does not require the court to ignore the facts that are against Ms. Washington's position and only take those that are in her favor. For example, the meeting with Tapscott, he specifically...
The benefit of reasonable inferences,
right, and I would,
is what I think I said.
I would argue that the inferences are not reasonable based on all of the evidence of record. For example, the position that Ms. Washington was transferred to was specifically created with the purpose of having the person there until 5 o'clock. The fact that her predecessor was not working to 5 o'clock was part of the impetus for creating that position and changing that as well.
But how odd to put the one person who needs this flex time so desperately into that particular position.
Your Honor, I would submit that the department didn't have to create a position to fit her hours. That was the position that was open that she could be transferred to. As the record showed as well, the other three positions that were open a few months previous did not allow flex time either. To require the department to create a position for her to transfer to that fit her needs is not required under the discrimination laws. I ask that this court please affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Wittern. Anything further, Mr. Baker?
Yes, Your Honor.
You've probably got about 30 seconds.
May it please the Court to address the issues that you raised, Judge Easterbrook, and the issues that you raised, Judge Rovner, real quickly. Judge Easterbrook, I think you were correct in your catbird scenario. The important thing that should be taken from this case is the individual facts of each and every case have to be taken into account, and I don't believe that the district court did that. With respect to your questions, Judge Rovner, I believe you are correct. The inferences have to go in Ms. Washington's favor. This was not a position that was created specifically so that someone could work until 5 o'clock. Ms. Smith, who had the job before, had worked 18 months in that position working a flexible schedule. 20 to 30% of the department. Thank you, Judge Easterbrook. Thank you.
The case is taken under advisement.